It's the KVMR Evening News for Friday, December 18th, 2011. For their support, we'd like to thank Club Rio Sailing School, offering a four-day beginning sailing course in the California Delta, including on-the-water training, classroom instruction, and American Sailing Association basic keelboat certification. For more information, give them a call at 916-966-1855 or go to clubriosailing.com. Citizens Bank, serving the community since 1995. With branches in Nevada City, Grass Valley, Penn Valley, Lake of the Pines, Truckee, and Auburn. Your community, your bank. That's CitizensBankNC.com. After the headlines, we'll hear reports on Bahrain's security forces opening fire on peaceful demonstrators with live ammunition. We'll also find out about Uganda's presidential and parliamentary elections, which were held today. George Rabane will give us a commentary, and Gary Chu will give us a movie review. Coming up at 6:30 this evening, it's this week's edition of Left, Right, and Center, and at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. But first, here are today's news headlines. The widened unrest in the Middle East took a more violent turn today as U.S. allied governments in Yemen and Bahrain opened fire on their citizens, prompting Britain and France to announce a halt in arms sales. The Washington Post reported that the use of live ammunition against pro-democracy protesters also triggered sharp criticism from President Obama, who urged authorities in Yemen, Bahrain, and Libya to show restraint and respect the rights of their people. The response from security forces was most heavy-handed in tiny Bahrain, home to the U.S. 5th Fleet, where soldiers used armored personnel carriers and machine guns to fire on protesters, wounding dozens, at least four of them critically. Bahrain's king tried to restore calm by appointing his son, the crown prince, to lead a dialogue with anti-government demonstrators, most of them Shiite Muslims, who are demanding greater representation and other democratic reforms in a country where most power is wielded by the Sunni minority. We will have more on this story later on in the newscast. The Australian ambassador to Sweden has written to the country's justice minister seeking assurances that Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, would be treated justly under Swedish and international law should he be extradited there. According to a report in the UK Guardian, Assange, an Australian citizen, is currently fighting extradition from Britain to Sweden over allegations of rape, sexual assault, and sexual molestation made by two women in August of last year, which he denies. In his letter to Sweden's Minister for Justice, Beatrice Ask, Ambassador Paul Stevens wants to convey the Australian government's expectation that should Mr. Assange be brought into Swedish jurisdiction, his case would proceed in accordance with due process and the provisions prescribed under Swedish law, as well as applicable European and international laws, including relevant human rights norms. Assange's lawyers argue that the conduct of the Swedish prosecutor has been illegal and/or corrupt in confirming his identity to the press against Swedish custom for accused sex offenders and issuing a warrant without charge. Assange will learn his fate on Thursday when Chief Magistrate Howard Riddle will deliver his judgment on the extradition warrant. President Barack Obama assembled some of the biggest names in Silicon Valley to confer on jobs and innovation, trying to get leaders from companies like Google and Apple behind his push to keep spending on high-tech initiatives, even as Republicans push to slash the budget. Today's Union reported that Facebook creator Mark Zuckerberg, Google chief executive Eric Schmidt, and Steve Jobs, the Apple founder and CEO, now on his third medical leave, were among a dozen business leaders who met with Obama in California last night. Also present for dinner at the Woodside home of venture capitalist John Doerr were the heads of Twitter, Yahoo, Netflix, Oracle, and the president of Stanford University. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said afterward that Obama wants to keep exchanging ideas with the group so we can work as partners to promote growth and create good jobs in the United States. The meeting was closed to the media. Obama wants to spend billions on clean energy, education, high-speed rail, faster internet service, and other programs, even as he calls for a 5-year freeze on domestic spending in other areas. The approach is getting a frosty reception from newly empowered Republicans on Capitol Hill who are pushing steep cuts to a range of programs and balking at new spending. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that a state drug agent repeatedly stole drugs from a Contra Costa County Sheriff's evidence locker and sold them with the help of a Concord private investigator, according to a complaint filed today. Norman Walsh, commander of the Central Contra Costa Narcotics Enforcement Team, sold the methamphetamine and marijuana on the same streets as he was sworn to protect, prosecutors said in a 28-count felony complaint. Most recently, Walsh sold methamphetamine for $5,000 on Tuesday, authorities said. He and his friend, private investigator Christopher Butler, are accused of taking seized drugs and selling them since at least November. The two, both former Antioch police officers, were arrested on Wednesday in Benicia by state drug agents. Governor Jerry Brown this morning ordered state agencies to stop buying keychains, coffee mugs, and other swag, saying the state spent $7.5 million on such items from 2007 to 2010, according to a report in today's Sacramento Bee. The order follows measures by the Democratic governor to recall thousands of state-issued cell phones and to reduce the state vehicle fleet in California's budget crisis. He ordered a hiring freeze this week as well. Brown, who is seeking to close a $26.6 billion budget deficit through cuts and tax extensions, faces a budget deadline next month. Brown said in his order that state agencies spent $7.5 million on items including keychains, squeeze toys, pens, hats, trinkets, shirts, cups, and other gift items known as swag or stuff we all get. The weather forecast for Nevada City, Grass Valley, and the foothills, according to the National Weather Service, is calling for rain before 10 p.m. this evening, then a rain and snow mix with a steady temperature around 36 degrees. The chance of precipitation is 100%. New snow accumulation of 2 to 4 inches is possible. On Saturday, a chance of rain and snow showers, mostly cloudy with a high near 41. Chance of precipitation is 50%. Little or no snow accumulation is expected. Saturday night, slight chance of snow showers, mostly cloudy with a low around 25. Chance of precipitation is 20%. On Sunday, a slight chance of rain and snow showers, mostly sunny with a high near 42. Chance of precipitation is 20%. Sunday night, slight chance of rain showers, snow level at 2,900 feet, mostly cloudy with a low around 28. Chance of precipitation is 20%. And on Washington's birthday in the foothills, a chance of rain and snow showers, partly sunny with a high near 46. Chance of precipitation is 30%. Little or no snow accumulation is expected. According to the National Weather Service, the weather for Sacramento tonight is calling for rain, with a low around 38 and a chance of precipitation of 100%. On Saturday, a 40% chance of showers, mostly cloudy, with a high near 50. On Saturday night, a 20% chance of showers, patchy frost after 4 a.m., otherwise mostly cloudy, with a low around 32. On Sunday, patchy frost before 10 a.m., otherwise mostly sunny, with a high near 52. On Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 36, and on Washington's birthday in the Sacramento area, there's a 20% chance of showers, partly sunny with a high near 54. In Truckee tonight, snow with a low around 21, new snow accumulation of 3 to 7 inches is possible. On Saturday, snow likely, cloudy with a high near 30, chance of precipitation is 60%, new snow accumulation of 1 to 2 inches is possible. On Saturday night, scattered snow showers, mostly cloudy with a low around 11. Chance of precipitation is 30%. New snow accumulation of less than a half an inch is possible. On Sunday, there's a 30% chance of snow showers, partly sunny with a high near 34. Little or no snow accumulation is expected. Sunday night, 20% chance of snow showers, mostly cloudy with a low around 10. And on Washington's birthday up in the Truckee area, there's a 30% chance of snow showers. It'll be mostly cloudy with a high near 33, little or no snow accumulation is expected. That's the KVMR Evening News Headlines. I'm Felton Pruitt.
In Bahrain, for the second day in a row, the security forces have opened fire on peaceful demonstrators. This video, posted on YouTube by Russia Today, shows people running for cover. Bahraini journalist Reem Khalifa told KPFA's Dennis Bernstein from Flashpoints what she saw.
The second massacre has happened today at around 4:35 o'clock Bahrain time. And we heard shots, you know, a real shot from the army. And since the army is not, you know, they're all mercenary and naturalized, so, you know, the army was shooting on the locals. And this is the problem in Bahrain. Our army and our police are not Bahrainis. This didn't happen in Egypt, and it didn't happen in Tunisia. An army will protect the people. In this country, it's the opposite.
Dozens of people have been wounded. Anna Neistat from Human Rights Watch described the scene in Bahrain's main hospital.
I'm currently in the hospital, and it's a total mayhem. There are many wounded people being brought here. So far, the doctors say 38, three of whom are in critical condition. But, of course, the numbers are not complete. All of the hospital rooms that I saw full of patients whom the doctors are trying to help. I spoke to several patients, and their story is pretty consistent. They're saying that after the funeral procession in Sitra was over, people moved back to the capital, and then they tried to get to the road that leads to Pearl Roundabout for the evening prayer. And as they approached this road and started praying, the army and police came against them and started shooting tear gas and rubber bullets and live ammunition.
Violence also continued in Yemen, where after successive days of protests, anti-government demonstrators were attacked by pro-government supporters wielding clubs and daggers in the capital, Sana'a. And AFP is reporting that in the city of Taiz, a grenade blast has killed two people and injured dozens. More violent clashes have also taken place in Libya. Human Rights Watch has said that yesterday's attacks on demonstrators killed at least 24 people there, and more casualties are expected after thousands rallied in Benghazi, Tripoli, and other cities today. Meanwhile, in Egypt, there was a different scene. Tens of thousands of people have gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square to mark 1 week since President Hosni Mubarak stepped down. The country's military rulers have entrusted a committee to work on drafting a new constitution.
Polls have closed in today's presidential and parliamentary elections in Uganda. Free Speech Radio News has this report on the elections.
The incumbent president, Yoweri Museveni, who's been in power since 1986, said this week that there would be no Egypt-like revolt in his country. He faces eight challengers, including the president's former doctor and army colonel, Kizza Besigye, and a female candidate, Betty Olive Kamya. Observers say polling took place peacefully in most districts, but some violence and intimidation was reported. According to the BBC, a journalist was shot by soldiers and dozens were injured after fights broke out amongst voters in the eastern part of the country. There are concerns about irregularities and fraud, including voters missing from registration lists and candidates' names missing from ballots. For more, let's go to Dr. Aaron Mushengyezi, a senior lecturer in the Department of Arts at Uganda's Makerere University. I started by asking Dr. Mushengyezi if he thought the disturbances at the polling booths were as bad as at previous elections.
Well, this poll has actually been the exact opposite. Right from the time of campaigns, it's been very peaceful. There have been a few isolated incidents of fighting here and there, but overall, it's been very peaceful.
A few days ago, President Museveni said there would be no Egypt-style uprising in Uganda. Are there concerns that that could happen, and if so, why?
Well, of course, when there's an uprising such as there was in Tunisia and Egypt, there's always a likelihood that people might get inspired by that. But I think in the case of Uganda, it's unlikely that that could happen. I mean, people could try, but I don't think it would succeed, really.
Some media reports quoted by the BBC said that there have been complaints from some people who say they registered to vote but have been unable to find their names on the roll. When you were there voting today, did you have any problems of that nature, or was that an issue for any people you saw at the polling station?
Some people were able to find their names in another station, but there have been cases where actually some people didn't find their names anywhere. So there is some truth to that.
Yoweri Museveni has been in power for 25 years. What's he done for the country in that time?
Quite a lot, actually, because when he came to power in 86, Uganda had really, everything had broken down. I remember going to school as a high school student. You couldn't even get salt or sugar from in the shops. I mean, everything was really imported. But right now, I think a number of products are available in the market. Industries have been built. The road infrastructure has been greatly improved countrywide. We still have terrible roads overall, but wherever you go, you see road construction projects. And above all, I think maybe his biggest achievement is the stability, the peace and stability in the country.
But Uganda's finance minister announced last month that the country was broke, and opposition candidates are actually blaming that on the president. They say he's been spending money bribing voters. What do you know about that?
There have been reports of people being given money, but I haven't received any myself. So I can't confirm that. But also this has been said to be happening on both sides.
What was his election campaign like?
He was talking mainly about providing free education, free second education for A-levels, and giving student loans to university students. He's also talking of improving the road infrastructure. He's talked of the oil. Uganda apparently has oil in the western part of the country.
And were there any restrictions placed on the opposition candidates and their campaigning?
Well, the campaign, I would say every candidate was free to canvass for votes. At least this time there was no report of anybody being stopped from campaigning like we had in 2006, giving gifts to voters in the villages and things like that. Personally, I wouldn't really have any. I couldn't verify such reports.
There's one female running for president, Betty Olive Kamya. Could you tell us a little bit about her and what sorts of policies she's advocating?
Betty Olive Kamya used to be a member of the FDC party, the leading opposition candidate, Kizza Besigye. But then she fell out with him and started her own party. And she's mainly been talking about setting up a federal system of government in the country. That has been her main priority issue in the campaigns.
What about the other opposition candidate you mentioned, Dr. Besigye? He's been around for some time. He told the BBC in an interview that the elections were rigged and that it would be a waste of time to go to court if there were allegations of fraud. Is that a view that many people in Uganda would agree with?
Well, he said that he's been to the courts in the last two elections, and the verdict of the courts, in his view, were not satisfactory to him. And so he says this time he won't go to the courts. He says he will appeal to the courts of public opinion, he calls it, which many people have interpreted to mean he'll go in for street protests or, you know, encouraging Egypt-like protests and so on. So that has quite scared many people in Uganda, because, as you know, we've had a long history of violence and war and conflict. So people are a little bit scared, actually. Especially his predisposition towards violence, you know, puts off many people. So it's a mixed bag of reactions towards him.
Another issue that has received a lot of attention is the repression of gays in Uganda. And recently, a rights activist, David Kata, was murdered. Are lesbian and gay rights any part of a candidate's campaign?
No. Surprisingly, none of the candidates has raised that issue as part of their campaign manifesto. I think partly because they know that the society is very anti-gay rights and things like that. So I suppose that's why the candidates kept away from it, because in the moment you talk about promoting gay rights, you definitely risk losing an election in Uganda.
Dr. Aaron Mushengezi, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Arts at Makerere University in Uganda, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And now, here's a commentary from George Rabane.
We Americans have always loved winners and see ourselves as winners, especially in this age of universal self-esteem. Oh yes, there is that phase we sometimes go through when we root for the underdog. But that lasts only as long as we can see the underdog eventually coming out on top, or at least making good. For popular champions, we seldom stick with a perennial loser. All of us look forward to Lucy's annual snatch of the football that once more lands Charlie Brown on his back. Something momentous happened on TV's Jeopardy this week, and I'm talking about momentous as in momentous for mankind. But let's go back a little bit before we examine what a computer called Watson did to the best that we humans could deliver. Way back when, there was a very popular and long-running TV quiz show called Let's Make a Deal, run by host Monty Hall. In it, the contestant wound up facing three doors, behind only one of which was a valuable prize. The contestant picked the door to open, then Monty Hall, who knew behind which door the prize was, opened one of the other doors that did not have the prize. Then came the moment of truth, when Monty asked the contestant whether he still wanted to open his originally chosen door or switch to the remaining closed door. The audience shouted advice until the contestant decided to switch or stick with his first choice. For years, the game was lots of fun for national audiences until someone took a look at the analytics behind the contestant's choice and discovered that it was always better to switch because it doubled your odds of winning the prize. The game, long thought to be a 50-50 toss-up, literally died overnight as all contestants switched doors. Since the optimum strategy or pat solution was now known, nobody cared. Uncertainty in the outcome was gone. Years later, more analytics were applied to the game of chess. This time the question was, can a machine be taught to play better chess than a human? Computer giant IBM developed a machine called Deep Blue that beat world champion and chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov. Today it is acknowledged that machines can play better chess than humans. And suddenly no one cared about world championship chess between humans. Why? Because everyone now knows that watching humans play chess is like watching the B team instead of a varsity game. When was the last time you saw the current champion, whoever that is, challenge a machine? But a lot of people discounted the machine after Kasparov's defeat by saying that chess was too simple of a game, and its mastery required just a brute force algorithm to search for the best among future possible moves. These same people said that humans would continue to dominate in areas where natural language was required, with all of its colloquialisms and grammatical quirks, and the domain of required knowledge was unlimited. In such arenas, humans would continue to dominate. Enter a computer called Watson. Again developed by IBM, Watson is a supercomputer that was built to answer natural language queries over an unlimited knowledge base. In fact, it could even do it backward. You tell it various parts of a complex answer, and Watson will come up with the question. That sure sounds a lot like the ever-popular TV game Jeopardy. And sure enough, this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Watson was pitted against the two all-time Jeopardy champions, and in front of a studio audience while standing behind its podium between the two human contestants, Watson beat them hands down. So from now on, everyone will know that when you tune into Jeopardy and watch humans compete, you know you're watching the B teams at play. Not only that, but the varsity player is too busy to even waste its valuable time with such a game, which remains difficult only for mere humans. My guess is that Jeopardy has lost its sizzle, and with no sizzle, there will be no steak. Period. End of story. but it is also the beginning of a brand new story about what Watson and its cheaper and even more accomplished successors will do with their valuable time. IBM is already in talks with leading firms in retail, medicine, finance, insurance, law, and yes, even governments for applications and jobs that were unheard of, especially for machines. Watson is the latest quantum leap in general artificial intelligence during these pre-singularity years, and it heralds that another huge segment of human talent will be displaced by machines. But now they have entered our last bastion of defense. They have penetrated our supposedly unique preserve, our cognitive redoubt. Never mind the camel's nose under the tent. The damn thing just walked in through the front door. My name is Rabain, and I also expand on these and other themes in my Union columns on NCTV and on georgerabain.com, where this transcript appears. These opinions are not necessarily shared by KVMR. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to the Friday edition of KVMR's Evening News. KVMR's news program airs Monday through Friday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. It's produced by the staff and volunteers of Community Radio, KVMR. Coming up at 6:30 this evening, we'll have this week's edition of Left, Right, and Center, and at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Closing out today's news program, we have a movie review from Gary Chu.
I kept expecting Richard Dreyfuss to make an entrance in the film Barney's version, but had to be satisfied with only seeing cameos of real-life film directors David Cronenberg and Adam Egoyan. Now, if that paragraph I just read to you is confusing, you may want to see Barney's version yourself to get your mind really mixed up a lot about not so much. To clarify, Richard Dreyfuss played the lead in the zany 1974 movie The Apprentice of Duddy Kravitz. Duddy's very entrepreneurial character also appears in the novel by Mordecai Richler titled Barney's Version. Michael Konovitz adapted it for the screen. Anyway, Barney Panofsky, the hero of Barney's Version, is the very successful Canadian television producer of a show called O'Malley of the North, for which Mr. Cronenberg and Mr. Egoyan are depicted as directors. That should make what I'm saying just as confusing, unless you are a certified film freak. And that's pretty much how, on the whole, Barney's Version comes off as a feature-length film. For the confused, it's a lugubrious tribute, I guess you could call it, to a guy who has nothing going for him and ginning up sympathy for his plight the character can't muster. The product is, as I say, opaque in its meaning for those seeing the film, without having more information that, of course, is contained in the novel. Not an uncommon oversight to find in a less than an effective screen adaptation. Turns out Mordecai Richler also wrote The Apprentice of Duddy Kravitz, and the acclaimed book Solomon Gursky was here. But since Barney's Version is actually Paul Giamatti's movie, he plays Barney, let's focus for a moment on the talented Mr. Giamatti. Giamatti also played Miles, the lead in that great 2004 movie Sideways. If you'll remember, Miles' sidekick in that film was named Jack, famously played by Thomas Hayden Church. If you've seen it, you'll recall with a most certain clarity what kind of jerk Jack was in Sideways. The best way to describe what kind of character, and I mean character, Barney Panofsky is in Barney's Version would be to simply say he bears a great similarity to Thomas Hayden Church's Jack, but Jewish. Yes, Barney is a clever, rude, robust party dog who's been known to tip way more than just a few, and way more than just once in a while. Barney also has this unbreakable bond with his father, Izzy Panofsky, played by Dustin Hoffman. This might be as close to genius director Robert J. Lewis gets, putting Hoffman in the movie. Izzy is a retired Montreal cop and widower who, even at his advanced age, still has eyes for the ladies. One of Barney's artiste friends, a writer called Boogie, is another party animal Barney consorts with. That's Scott Speedman's role. Boogie might be the author Mordecai Richler, thinly disguised, but then again, so too might Richler be Barney. The first half of the Barney movie clips along nicely and allows for laughs that come easily, while the second part goes into a sudden stall and loses altitude with schwerik turns in the story intended to make everyone tear up for Barney for what he, mostly on his own, has wrought. Standouts are, of course, Giamatti in the title role, and Minnie Driver as the unnamed second wife, who is so entertainingly Jewish you won't believe it. Rosamund Pike makes a steady reading of Barney's very grounded wife number three, Miriam, who might have a crush on Saul Bellow, but we can't be sure. And in a brief turn, Rochelle Lefevre plays first wife Clara, a sexy blue-tongued gal who can linguistically one-up old Barney in the gross-out department any time. Shades of Larry David up against Susie Essman on Curb Your Enthusiasm, I guess. Alas, it's such a schleck thing that Barney's version plays too much to the wings, where most of the movie's admirers are surely watching and laughing their tuchuses off. The guy with this voice closes off, hoping you read his numerous film reviews online at TulsaTVMemories.com or at IMDb.com, the International Movie Database. I'm Gary Chu, down in the valley.
That's it for our news program this evening. KVMR's Evening News airs Monday through Friday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. and is produced by the volunteers and staff of Community Radio KVMR. We'd like to thank George Rabane and Gary Chu for their help in this evening's newscast. Up next, it's Left, Right, and Center, and at 7 o'clock, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. For KVMR's Evening News, I'm Felton Pruitt. Have a wonderful weekend.